Welcome to Fossils by Firelight, a series of conversations with South Africa's geological legends, where they unearth their discoveries, learnings, memories, interesting stories, and maybe a few tall tales to chronicle our history and inspire the next generation of geological heroes.
Thank you so much to the GSSA and SAI Bank for the invitation for me to have this conversation and share with you this morning. Most of us have had a one-day project, something that you are going to get around to doing one day. Maybe when the kids have left school. Maybe when work settles down. Maybe it's something that you think about each year when your birthday rolls around, and it quietly, very so subtly, keeps tapping you on the shoulder that you should do something about this. Everest was my one-day project, clearly. Problem was, it took me about 50 years to realize this. So 7,950 meters above sea level at the South Col is not a place for ambition. The wind howls, and it's actually more of a place for accounting. What happens at the South Col is we figure out, have we got sufficient oxygen left after making the very long journey from Cat 3 up to the South Col? It's accounting in terms of what fuel, what resources we're going to need to be able to get up to Everest. And it's also about reflecting. It's a weird place. You don't have much here, there. And it's quiet. It's silent. It's about the accounting of how one actually gets to a point of sitting on the South Col, getting ready to get to the highest point on Earth. Well, for me, this started way back when, down in the Eastern Cape, good old PE. And this is me in Standard 5, grade 7. And I spent a lot of my time outdoors hiking, as well as being involved with organizations like Falcon Flag. Anybody remember Falcon Flag? It's kind of a rite of passage. And then Falcon Flag became Outward Bound, so I was an instructor in that space. And really just spent a lot of my time in the mountains from a hobby perspective. And the reason why this journey for Everest is 30 years for me was that in 1995, when I was studying geology at Rhodes, there was an advertisement in the Sunday Times where they were going to hold a competition for a woman to join the first South African expedition up Everest. And this piece of newspaper stayed on my study desk for quite a while, and I was deliberating. Do I enter this competition? Don't I? I knew sort of the network and I knew what had to be done. Anyway, I looked at it long and hard and I went into mine. And so, as Gary alludes to, yes, I've been very fortunate to be able to be part of some really seminal mining projects in South Africa. And in fact, Digby was just commenting there earlier where we were talking about the good old Target days. Being able to be the first woman to work on any of the mines that I worked on was a real honor and privilege, being able to be part of cutting edge technology at the time, what we were doing at Target, moving on various Anglo-Vaal projects into Anglo-American. And for me, it's always been about that change, the challenge that technology can bring, what you can do through change. I then went to Australia where I deployed the very first LTE network in Papua New Guinea and in the parts of Australia. Effectively, there the mines all ran our network, but they wanted the best-in-grade communications network. So the trucks couldn't fall off the network, and they came to Telstra and they said, hey, Telstra, that network that you provide, the police, fire, and ambulance, can we have some of that? You don't want it for free, you'll pay for it. But can you set it up for us? So that is the journey of setting up mining for one of the biggest telcos in the world, as well as a range of other telecommunications and technology projects as well. But most of you who know me in the room, and those of you who don't, will know that it's always been a passion of mine to merge my mining and my mountaineering. And so this is 10 years ago now. It's actually quite amazing. Is that this is an incredible trip that we did for the GSSA, where we went to the deepest point on the African continent, which is down in Pune. And then we all went up to the top of Kilimanjaro. So the trip was to take people to the deepest point of the African continent and the highest point of the African continent. And that distance is actually more than Everest, like it's about 9,000 meters. But the ability to work with teams in various of these environments is what's really stood by me for my entire career. The first time I saw Everest was in 2011. I was taking a group on my leave. I was using all my leave to go to the mountains. This is a lady from America. She decided that if Edmund Hillary and Ernest Shapp, all of them could wear layers of wool to get up, she decided she would do the same to Everest Base Camp this way. She's an energy economist. She was 72. I mean, this is the north side of Everest. So I went to the north side of Everest as well on a smaller expedition. And this is how I got introduced to the journey of going up Everest. But more than that, it was around, once again, working with teams, taking people into the outdoors and seeing the life-transforming effect that being in the outdoors can have on people, but also my own objectives, my own goals. And there are 14 mountains in the world that are above 8,000 meters. The most well-known is Everest, but there are 13 others. There was a movie on Netflix about those 14 movies. And on my journey, I'm first South African to climb three other mountains as well. So my high altitude journey has definitely taken me over the years. So when most people think about Everest, this is what happens. Everest season rolls around every year, and these three headlines get regurgitated into the press. The first headline is around the dead bodies that are there. I will share from personal experience that this is not the number. In my station last year, there are two known bodies that we know about that you've traversed past. And then there are the people that unfortunately pass away during the season. And those get removed very quickly. So this headline is not how things are on Everest in practice. The second headline that often gets talked about, and I'll quickly jump back to the dead bodies part of things. How many people die during the Ironman? Yeah, in total. Since the Ironman, the full Ironman has been around, how many people do you think have died running the Ironman? 254. How many people have died on Everest? 320. I appreciate there'll be some people who tell me, come on, that's like really quite apples versus apples. But it's an order of a magnitude, and it's something which people don't realize just how many people die during the Ironman. It's far less publicized. If we look at the lines, that's a very famous picture that a lot of people see. UTMB in Chamonix. How many people rock up in Chamonix to deal with the trail running event in Chamonix? This event takes 1 weekend. It's about a 10-day festival of trail running. An Everest expedition takes 6 weeks. 10,000 people go and run the trails in Europe. 700 of us got Everest. But one photo got taken 1 year where the conditions were such that there was this traffic jam. And that's the image that gets brought up. This is roughly what it looks like. This is going up the Lhotse place, going up to the other bad. And yes, there's people. But post-COVID, everybody has gone outdoors. And so I think from a realization of practicalities, it's around the tangible things. And that's the third headline. It's around the trash. And so all these events, trash is a problem. And yes, also from a mountaineering perspective, the South Col is a problem. But a lot of good is also being done. And we have a program in Nepal called Sadamark the Nest. And they take all the equipment that's been left in the mountains, and they actually doing recreative art projects for them. This is an installation where they use tents, broken up tents, to create art installation. On Amadablam, a mountain which is really dangerous and it has the spider web of ropes on it, they remove all the ropes every season now, and they create things like this. This is a yak made out of rope that they have unwound. What's important here is that this yak was sold, these yaks sold for $5,000. And so the opportunity in that community, in the remote Nepalese communities, such that it's not now only about the mountains, it's about being able to support artists and show them the knock-on effects of these things. So these are stories which are very much underplayed. When in every season, the press loves to hop onto the bodies, lines, and trash narrative. For me, the most important headline around Everest is this one. It is the snows, it's the climate change, it's the fact that the things on the mountain are changing, and it makes climbing Everest a lot more dangerous. This picture is from 2018, and this is the final summit ridge on Everest, the south summit of the Pierre. And all of the snow does not exist anymore. It's a rock climb. So all of this has been denuded and gone away. Those are the challenges that we're dealing with at the moment. And similarly, in the Aspall, bearing up the Aspall, this is from 2018, really clear, open, fine. And this is what it looked like last year. And this is where then, yes, you've got to be able to know the practicalities of how you jump and get through these things. And they shift and they move as the season goes on. So it's an ever-moving chess game, Tetris game, negotiating, things like this. And so I think for me, the headline that's most important is around how do we manage the climate impacts as we go into the mountains. So I had done all of that stuff, and I know the headlines, and I know what people talk about Everest, but I really decided that I needed to listen to it. I coached other people to climb Everest, in fact. With my 8,000-meter experience, I had dropped people to the summit of Everest, but it was something that I'd never really thought of. It was just one day, I might do it. Maybe I'll do it someday. And during COVID, I ended up looking at old photographs, Polaroids, if you take it, base camp, things like that. Also, what happened was that the pain and torture of an 8,000-meter mountain expedition wore off. So pain points like this, I'd forgotten about how challenging and how hard an 8,000-meter mountain expedition can be. And I really thought to myself, you know, I want to be able to give this a really good go. So I did. In 2023, I did a mountain. I took a group of people at Merah Peak, and then I proceeded to get into base camp. Except in 2023, we're so close to after COVID that the resilience in terms of survivors and staff was just not there. And everybody got sick. And so what you're seeing in this photograph here is various climbers, that's me in green, over steaming bowls of hot water, the tiger balm in it, to try and just open our nasal passages because it's so cold and so dry in the Khumbu, to try and see if we could get up these mountains. But I got very, very sick. I got to Camp 2, and Saba Camp 2 looked at the amazing view and just knew that it would be nonsensical for me to carry on with this climb 2023. So I turned around and plodded my way back down the mountain. In 2024, I then returned again, and it was a completely different season. And this is my friend Funjo. She went down to get the speed record. She climbed Everest, got into top in 15 hours. She's the fastest woman to climb Everest. And so it's really great, the camaraderie and the people that you just keep on the mountain. And things were going amazingly in 2024. Until they weren't. So whilst I was climbing on 2024, the police called me and I got word that my house burnt down. And then my gear failed. So my Jumar, the ascender that I was using on the mountain, also failed. And it's like, how can these things just get curveballs, get thrown at you? You know, I didn't know what was left. Basically nothing on my things. The gear just was not supposed to fail. It was a mechanical device that failed. I did get up to the South Col, and the weather was perfect. It was a textbook day, but actually the conditions being textbook is exactly why I left the mountain at the South Col. I just knew the risks were too high in terms of oxygen and where my headspace was from these previous things. So I turned around again and came all the way back down the mountain. When I regrouped after 2024, I thought to myself, you know, if I'm 84 on my stroller, my Zimmer frame, I will probably regret not getting this mountain one more chance. And there was so much people were saying, you shouldn't, it's crazy, there's all people, there's lions and all of this stuff. And I then thought about it even more and said, if somebody could have confirmed and made sure that I would summit, but I wasn't allowed to tell anybody about getting up at this, would I still have gone? If they could have assured that I would be the summit, my answer was yes, which was that it became such an important project to myself. Forget about anybody else in the world. I wanted to get to Everest. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to extend my sabbatical another 6 months and I'm going to knuckle down and give this one more chance. So the beauty about having a house of one's going down is that you're suddenly flexible. So I packed a bag and I went across to New Zealand. And it's great for training in New Zealand. There's mountains on the doorstep. And there's lots of great ice cream in New Zealand. And I just knuckled down. I didn't know a soul in New Zealand. I just trained every single day to get to the mountain again, which I did. So this was last year. This is my base camp. It's Everest Base Camp. These are other climbers doing their own projects. And a great environment to rest and recover in. And off I went again. So I had Cherry as my main Sherpa. Cherry has the speed record for K2. He's climbed K2 in 8 hours. So nothing to say that I keep the company of his speed record. People talks about my pace. It all of him doesn't. But going back to the treacheries of moving through the icefall and the rigors of getting oneself back positioned on the mountain. So this is the realities of climbing Everest. Yes, there are fixed lines. Yes, they assist you to be able to climb up. Photograph always, it's like fish. You know, our fish always look bigger in our pictures. Climbing the slope never looks as steep as it really is. But this is the latency place. This is where my gear failed the year before. It didn't fail this year. And we just carried on up. And so I ended up back at the South Col again, sitting in the tent, figuring out my oxygen, thinking back on the points that had actually got me to this place. The wind was howling. Last year, the weather was extreme. This is the wet wind coming off the south summit of Everest. And just had to decide, are we going to go and do it? And so cheering in myself, resting in the tent, going, you know what, we can do this. We can get out and do this. And so that night I left. I went up to the balcony. The balcony is 8,490 meters above sea level. It takes about 4 to 5 hours to get there. It's really steep. And when we got there, the winds were extreme. People couldn't stand up straight. And there was ice covering our faces and everything. And I just knew this was not safe. What a dangerous. So we turned around. So again, I turned around and I got myself back down to the South Col. And the South Col, as I say, it's not comfortable. There's nothing ambitious about getting to the South Col. It's bodies lying around in this altitude stupor, as it were. And my plan had actually been to climb both Everest and Lhotse, because, you know, I'm just an underperformer. And so I had sufficient resources to consider going up the next night. There were about 100 people who went up that evening, but they didn't have the supplies, and everybody left Everest. And I was left at the South Col with myself, a couple of Sherpas to help me. I was climbing independently. I don't do social company. And after sitting around like this for a few hours, my Sherpa was sick. During that was in those photographs, he had to descend down the cap too. He was sick. And he called me on the radio and he said to me, Jeanette, no, don't go to Lhotse. Go to Everest again. And I said to him, you're mad. I've just climbed to 8,500 meters. I've expended a lot of energy to do that. You were now wanting me to go back to the balcony and onto the summit? And he said, yes, you can do it. You're really strong. And so everybody else had left down the mountain. And I saddled on up. And I went to the balcony and I parried on up Everest. And one of my lifetime goals has always been to be able to see the sunrise in the mountain, to be able to go and see the sunrise from Everest. Kept on plodding. Carry on plodding for a while. And then, yes, got to the summit of Everest. I had a temporary Sherpa with me. You're not used to working with clients. He took 3 very unspectacular pictures of me on Everest. But it wasn't about that. Like, no, it wasn't that at all. It was the fact that after having put that application in 1995 and they rescinded it, everything that had gone through the years, was the opportunity to stand here, and I was alone. Besides the stroke of the cupcake, you carried some oxygen. Nobody else was on the mountain as well. And it was an incredible honor to be able to be in this position. On the 9th, South African woman to climb from the south side, in total 48 South Africans to date in Sanatok. That's fabulous. So if you put that into 48 divided by 62 million, you know, the numbers, it feels like everybody's doing it. That's not the case at all. And yes, some people now know as well, women should never tell their age, but unfortunately it is in the press that I'm the oldest South African. So I've done this as well. It's now been 9 months since I climbed Everest. This month will be my 9th month. And people often ask me, so how does it feel afterwards? What happens afterwards? Firstly, for me, it was about getting back to being around people. Yes, this is a outdoors picture, but it's also been for me getting back into the boardroom, getting back into the professional space, reconnecting with people, because training for Mount Everest is an exceptionally solitary experience. Most people who have to knuckle down and climb these mountains, it ends up being pretty solitary outdoors. And so for me to be able to reconnect with people has been fantastic. I did go to Nepal in November last year, and I took a group of people to base camp. And for me, just to sit in the sunset and look at the summit of Everest and just know that I had an opportunity to stand on the tippy top was a very cool experience for me. It released a lot of weight to myself, and the opportunity to just reflect on that was significant. I'm now asked a lot about what is it that you're doing now with yourself. So I have a portfolio career where I sit on company boards, tech and voluntary boards. I run the Mountain Protection Award for the UIAA, which is out of Bern in Switzerland, which is about protecting mountains in the current narrative. And then I also coach people to get their own up the mountain objectives, and I still be spoke. So I'm running a portfolio career at the moment. And I've also been able to reflect on the things that actually got me up this mountain. I had to commit. You heard at 2023 and 2024 was there, but actually I hadn't committed 150% when it spoke around my Everest goal publicly or a lot. Eventually in 2025, I went, I am 100% committed to this. And yes, when you commit to something, you've got to know to other things. But I think the level of commitment you've got to have to some of these things is what gets you there at the end of the day. Then the consistency, power band is boring, but you've got to do something every day. And the little green dots are on a calendar, they do add up to something. So it's not masses. It was never like 15, 16 hours. It was the half hours, the 20-minute sessions in the gym. It's that consistency that builds up along the way through these big projects. And then courage. There has to be courage to carry on when your PowerPoint plays up. Yeah, just the general courage to be able to just do it as it is. And so, you know, a few weeks ago, I was walking in the street and somebody came up to me and they said, hey, Jeanette, I listened to your talk a few months ago and you're never going to guess what happened. I said, well, what happened? And they said to me, I started writing a book. I listened to your talk and I've started to write a book. And I was like, wow. And that took that away with me and I reflected on it. And for me, the fact that they had now just sat and written a couple of pages, it wasn't something dramatic. It was actually quite ordinary. It was the mere fact that they weren't thinking about the mountain totality. It was the fact that they just began what they would do. And so that big thing that you might have been consistently putting off, maybe the question isn't, are you ready for the big thing? Maybe the question you should be asking yourself, are you willing to begin?
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.